Struggling to move your nonprofit forward? You've come to the right place. Welcome to The Nonprofit Architect, where we are giving you the actionable steps you need to launch and grow your nonprofit organization. Now, here's your host, Travis Johnson.
Do you feel your nonprofit's not getting enough in monthly recurring donations? If so, then you need sharing the credit. Every time you go into a business and swipe your debit or credit card, one of the fees taken out by Visa and MasterCard at the end of the month goes back into the system. Now, normally this is a bank, but it is legally allowed to go to a registered nonprofit. Sharing the credit worked with a small local nonprofit. They took this information to their donor base, and 19 businesses started using sharing the credit. Now, this small local nonprofit receives $11,000 in monthly recurring, unrestricted, ongoing donations. This is the definition of sustainable funding. Businesses have to take plastic, so they might as well use part of those fees to support their favorite cause, your nonprofit. Check out my affiliate link in the show notes for sharing the credit. Book a call with Will Black and start your journey to more donations and better relationships today. Hey, welcome back to the show. I'm here with Jamie Van Kuyk. Jamie, how are you doing today?
I'm doing really well, Travis. Thank you so much for having me.
This has been crazy because this is like the third time we've talked in like 2 weeks. We said hello, then I was a guest on your show, then you're a guest on my show. I don't know what I'm going to do next week. I'm going to feel kind of Jamie-less.
I know. We'll just have to figure out another reason to get together.
Perfect. Yeah, Jamie runs the Growing Your Team podcast, and I had a lot of things to say about military and small business and podcast teams and all that fun stuff. But why don't you give us a little bit of your background, Jamie, who you are, what you do, why you do it?
Yes. My business is called Growing Your Team, and we guide small business owners through the hiring process. I kind of stumbled on creating this business. It's really a weird journey. I came from corporate leadership. I wasn't in HR, but I was leading a team on the internal operations where I got a lot of experience with hiring because it was entry level. So people would come in and then a lot of times branch elsewhere into the company. And of course, my team was amazing. So my team members were always getting poached, which meant I was pretty much always hiring. But then we had a bunch of other managers that led very similar teams. The same thing was happening to them, but they didn't have time to go and do interviews and review resumes. And our HR department was always backed up. So I was like, I'll help. How can I help? I'll review the resumes instead of having HR do them. I'll do the initial phone screen instead of having HR do them because they don't have time because they are short-staffed in HR. And I'm like, okay, even though our teams are doing slightly the same thing, there's difference because there's different nuances with all the accounts that they work on. So tell me, what do you need for this account? So I got very good at figuring out what people really needed for their team and did a lot of work with the HR departments to really learn what goes into the entire hiring process. Left that to start another business that I quickly realized was not for me, but then sat there. I was like, what do I do now? I'm not ready to go back to corporate. And I had realized that I loved consulting during that time because I did some one-off consulting projects while I was starting that other business. Started talking to a bunch of business owners, small business owners. And when we talked about issues going on in our business, they always said their number one problem was hiring. And I was like, really? And that's when I learned that most small business owners never hired before doing it within their own business. Or if they did hire, it was when they were with corporate and they had amazing HR teams and senior leadership that pretty much did almost everything for them. And they are finally realizing everything that went into hiring a good employee. And they're like, we're lost. Help us. So finally, one day I was like, all right, I've been hearing this enough. I know how to hire well. I know how, even though I came from corporate, to break things down in a way that works for small businesses. So let's do it. Now it's been 4 years since Growing Your Team launched and loving everything that we do for small businesses.
That's really exciting. I wanted to have you on because nonprofits face the same challenges. A lot of them just don't understand how to find the right people, how to hire, whether it's hire for a paycheck or really to cultivate volunteers. And because that skill is so low in the nonprofit sector, they have a huge turnover rate, average turnover rate, 18 months for anybody. Doesn't matter if they're the lowest rung or the top billet as executive director, people are not sticking around. They have no idea how to build and cultivate teams, find the right people, get them on board, and really develop them. And it's just a shame because people get in for the altruistic reason of wanting to help and then realize there's no support for them as employees or volunteers.
Yeah, I definitely agree with all that. I feel like any problem that a small business has is kind of like it's blown up inside a nonprofit. And sometimes because hiring is looked at as, should I be spending my donors' dollars on a person versus doing something else with those dollars inside the nonprofit? So I feel like they put off hiring the people that they need for way too long. And then when they go to hire, it's, let's find someone that really supports our mission. We're mission driven, mission everything. And they don't always look for the right skills. And then so sometimes they put the wrong people in the positions. And that's one of the reasons people are leaving. And then the other thing is, Travis, is just like you said, it's then this thing of they're not ready to really cultivate employees internally. And it creates a lot of turnover because even though they love the mission, they don't feel connected to the job.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. People want to hire for skills and then not train anyone when they show up, which is crazy. We talked about when I was a guest on your show, how the military does it. You take someone off the street, you assume they know nothing. You bring them into boot camp, teach them how to march, fold your clothes, do laundry, shave, all the like super basics, teach them a little bit about the Navy. Then you send them to a job specific school, their niche, the thing that they're supposed to learn, their job rating. They go through that school, but like in aviation, you've got so many different types of airplanes. So after you leave that school, you go to an airplane specific school to learn how to do it. But then you get to your squadron, you've still never done your job yet. So even though you have all this training in all these schools, you show up and you still don't know how to operate within the shop or within the office. So you still have more on the job training, ongoing skills building, learning the people, the systems, all the things you have to do. I mean, shoot, just the paperwork alone is this whole other thing you've got to learn. And that's how the military does it. But in like the nonprofit world or the small business world, they're like, we're going to hire someone that's got these skills. They're going to come on and they're going to crush it. Well, they don't know who their boss is. They don't know how they work with teams. They don't know the expectations that are set before them, you know, unless you tell them. So right. I know you have this hire framework, H-I-R-E, that you want to talk about today. Go ahead and talk a little bit about how you created this framework, and then we'll hop right in.
Yeah. So with creating the framework, it was really breaking down, what do you need to do to get a good hire on your team? That it's not about just going out and saying, hey, we're hiring. You love our mission. You love what we do. Come work with us. It's saying, okay, you might have people who want to work for you, but who is that person who should be working for you? And how do you go from having that need to hire to having a fully trained team member who's going to meet your expectations and be happy with your organization, and also you be happy with them? So the hire framework breaks the process into four main steps based on what you should be doing in each one of those steps to get the idea team member. So the first place we start is with H, which we call the hiring details. You can't hire the right person for you if you don't know who the right person is. And a part of it, you can sit there and say, well, their title is XYZ. That's a basic title. Okay, yeah, maybe. Maybe that title exists in every nonprofit that's out there. But what does it mean inside your organization? What are your processes and systems that are already set up? Are you very on top of things where you already have, like, you're using project management tools, you have all these systems, you have all these workflows created, and you need someone who can come in and just do all that? Or do you need someone who's going to be able to help you organize the mess that's going on internally and create those processes and those workflows and everything? So it's very different. Who are your clients that you're working with? What's going to make you happy to give this person a paycheck, especially if they're a paid team member? Because once again, as we talked about, Travis, like in nonprofits, paying someone is what holds people back from hiring a lot, because they want to make sure that every dollar that goes out is a dollar of value. So how can you make sure the person that you hire deserves that dollar before they're ever hired? And it's going through and creating, who is this idea candidate? Not just the basic tasks they're going to do, not just the title, but figuring out, what does success look like? What is this true picture of this idea candidate that I'm going to be happy with? And you need to start there, because one thing you'll realize throughout the rest of the framework, it all ties back to those hiring details. So if you don't spend time really figuring out those hiring details, chances are the rest of the process is going to either be a challenge or it's going to lead you to the wrong person.
Do you figure in like personality types when you're doing this framework, when you're basically writing the job description? Are you trying to figure out if you need someone that's bold, that's going to speak up? Do you need someone that's going to sit back and just be analytical? Do you need someone that's just going to sit down and just chug away and plug and do the work? Like, is that something you decide before you create this description?
Yes, in a lot of ways we do. There's a lot of things where people think like personality assessments and all this, and sometimes they get into that mindset of only someone with this type of personality can do this type of job. And that's not true. If you looked at, for example, when I was back in corporate, we did a personality assessment with our team of account managers, and they were all so different. But we had a team of amazing account managers. And if I said, well, this is the personality that we're looking for and we need for everything across the board, I would have not had all my rockstar team members, because I would have just excluded people because they didn't fall into that bucket. So we don't want to pigeonhole ourselves so much that we think good talent can't do the job just because they're not a certain personality. However, what we do is say, you're running a nonprofit. Typically, there's not a whole lot of people there. So what's really going to fit in with that, in a way, company culture, how you work with people? You don't want someone who's going to be coming in and every day you're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they did that again. I can't stand working with this person, because working with them is important. And it's not a large organization where they can just like hide in the organization. Like, you're really going to feel that dynamic across people. When it comes to things like you said, like being bold or things like that, those are things that when someone tells me that, I'm like, why is that important? And they might be like, well, this is a position that really has to go out and help us become known in the community. Not a lot of people know us yet. So they need to be willing to go to networking events, start those conversations, ask people at those events to come and have coffee with them. Or if you have a physical location, come see your mission in action, you know, things like that, where that's maybe what they mean by being bold. But being bold doesn't necessarily mean, well, being bossy and pushy and getting people's faces so people hate them being around. So it's figuring out, what do you need and why do you need it? So that way we're not just saying, okay, is this person bold when we go through the process? It's, can this person do what we need done because they have the right skill set and personality to go into those situations and do things that we want? Some of the other things is, I've worked with nonprofits that, with the type of clients that they work with, they need people who are very good at working with people in high stress situations. Every one of their clients is in a high stress situation, and can they deal with those situations? Do they have the patience? Do they accept diversity and understanding that this person's not in this situation because of, you know, something that they can't control? Like, this could happen to anybody. So do they have patience and are open to working with those things? So it's like figuring out, what does that really look like? Personality plays a part of it. But like I said, we dig into that deeper. Why is this important? So then we focus on the right things throughout the process.
Yeah, I like that. You mentioned the word bold, and then you went into a definition of the word. And it's important to understand why someone picked the word that they picked. Have you ever looked at a bill that's being written by Congress? Like the actual text of it?
Have I actually read it? No, maybe bits and pieces, but not really. Well,
most people
thing.
Don't, right? Most people find whatever clause that they care about, and it's on social media and all this stuff. When you read a bill that's being proposed, or even when that's been written, the first thing they do is they define a bunch of terms. They have a term, and then they define it how it's going to be used within the text. If you don't define what some of that stuff is, if you don't define what bold means to you, I mean, because you can use bold to define a hot sauce. You can use bold to define a person. You can use bold to define a color. But unless you really define what exactly that you mean by bold, do you mean outgoing? Do you mean outspoken? Do you mean someone that's going to challenge you as a boss? If you don't define exactly what that is, people won't understand what you're going for and what you need out of them. Because what's the famous military one? If you ask someone in the Marine Corps to secure a building, they're going to go in with guns drawn 2x2 to make sure that the building's clear. If you ask someone in the Air Force to secure the building, they're going to make sure all the doors are closed and locked before they leave for the weekend. secure does not mean the same thing to different groups of people. So understanding exactly how it's defined and what context it's used in is vital to the success of whatever it is that you're doing.
Yes, exactly. 100%. So then, you know, with the framework, once you figure out those hiring details, we move to the next step, which is the I. And so we call that initiating the advertising plan, because people can't apply for your job if they don't know that the job exists. So you need to tell people that the job exists. And like I said, it's more than just saying, we're hiring and expecting all these great people to flock to you. It's really telling people what is the job and who is right for the job. Because like we talked about those hiring details, you developed that idea candidate in your mind, that idea person that you wanted to hire who will do really well in that job. So you need to tell people who that idea candidate is through the use of a job posting. So you need to create that job posting. Don't want to create a job posting that's super, super long, but it also needs to get out the right information. So typically a job posting has a brief, no more than 3 sentences, overview of the organization. Who are you? What do you do? Who do you serve? Don't assume that everybody knows, right? Then you get to a brief overview of the job. Once again, no more than 3 sentences. But what is the basic role of the job and who is right for the position? So that's where some of those things that we start to pull out, and we wouldn't necessarily just say account director. It's like, well, what does it mean? We might use the word, you're a bold account director who does, and then add in additional things. So we're really describing who it is that we're looking for. Your job posting should also include a bulleted list of the typical responsibilities. I say that list should be no more than 20 bullet points, and 20 might be pushing it a little bit too far. So figure out how do you combine things, because you don't need to give everything there, but you need to give them a good picture of what they're going to be doing day to day. You then list out the requirements. So if they need a certain degree, if they need to have done this position before, if they've need experience working with nonprofits, is it a full-time position? Is it a part-time position? Is it a position that is standard office hours? Or a lot of times in nonprofits, it requires evenings and weekends because they're going to events and meeting with donors and going to board meetings. So what are those requirements of the job? And then if you offer them benefits, what are the benefits? Do you offer health insurance? Do you offer paid vacation? And any of those things that are there. So the purpose of the job posting is for when someone sees it, they can say, yes, that is the job for me. Or no, that doesn't describe me. I'll go look at the next opportunity.
Oh, I love that. You touched on one of the things that really has bugged me over the last couple of years. And I want to know if you've seen this. You mentioned whether or not a degree is required. And so many companies right now, bigger industries like Google, are saying we don't require a degree. We care about these skills more than we care about the degree. Have you seen where you have this enormous job listing and they say all these things, and if you got 40 things listed out they want you to do, and they say master's degree required, and then they say $12 an hour?
Yeah, so I've seen like those things circling around. And I think this degree thing is such an important thing to talk about, because I don't think a degree is required all the time. And I think you need to ask yourself, why? Why is a degree required? So for example, I was recently working with a nonprofit, and because of the work that they do in the area of expertise, you can't be doing that without a degree. You know, they need some sort of degree that has given them the education that is needed to be certified in those areas. So for those, it's like adding it on. So someone else couldn't be reading this and being like, well, I'd be interested in that. It's like making a call out of, no, you need a degree because it's the only way you're legally allowed to do this work with us. There's other areas where I say, especially the more experience you want the person to have, a degree doesn't matter. If you're looking for someone that with experience, the experience is what has mattered. What have they actually done throughout their career? What makes them qualified? And a degree they got 10 years ago, 15 years ago, even 5 years ago sometimes doesn't matter. It's what they've been doing since getting that degree. Now, there's sometimes with entry level, some of the lower level positions, we'll be more likely to put a degree on there as a requirement because they're looking for different things, where having that degree could mean they're dedicated to something. They got through that program, or they don't have a lot of in the field working knowledge yet, but they were able to gather a certain knowledge through this degree program. So we know that they're not coming in with nothing, even though they're still entry level in the workforce. But to give you an example of this is, a while ago, I was working with a nonprofit and they were hiring a team member, and they on the job posting they originally gave me had a requirement for a degree. But when we went through everything that they were really looking for, there was nothing in there that required a degree. And they were also looking for someone who had probably, I think it was about 8 years of experience. And so when I put together the job posting that we used with Help Them with Recruiting, we left the degree off completely. When they found their new team member and they went to go write the introduction email to send out internally of this person is joining us, they realized that this person hadn't graduated college. They didn't have a degree. And they're like, what do we do? Like, it was a requirement of ours. We see that it didn't end up on the job posting. What do we do? And I was like, well, let's look at your job posting that you originally had. It was degree or equivalent experience. What is equivalent experience? This person has 10 years of experience doing something very similar. If 10 years of experience is not enough to say, or equivalent experience, how much is? And like, once we were able to look at it that way, it's like, okay, yeah, this person could have got a degree 10 years ago in something completely unrelevant to this position, or they have 10 years of experience doing things that make them the perfect candidate for this experience. What is better to tell your team internally? A degree doesn't make them qualified. It was that experience that made them qualified.
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at the overarching degrees, largely don't matter unless you're a doctor, lawyer, dentist, engineer. When you get into some of the more fine-tuned specific things, you can get something like licensed professional counselor or licensed professional social worker. Those things would require a degree. But by and large, I can't think of a lot of reasons why a degree would really matter unless you get some higher position, like working through the program to become like a head of a hospital. Like, there's certain types of degrees that are much more relevant to a position like that. But it's just so interesting that you see these and they're like, yeah, we want 10 years experience and you got to have 3 master's degrees and we're going to give you $9 an hour. Like, what are you hoping for? What kind of dynamo, if you're a business or if you're a nonprofit, like, who do you think is going to show up for that job listing? Who's going to have all that experience and all the craziness that you need, and it's like $9 an hour? Yeah, I'm definitely on board for that. Like, who do you expect to show up?
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things, like in the nonprofit world, it's like, well, they're going to work for us because they really care about the mission. But it doesn't matter how much they care about the mission. If they're working for money, they still need to keep a roof over their head and food on the table. They need to make a living. And so unless what you're looking for is, I don't know, possibly the housewife of some rich person who's not working for the money, you're not going to get good people at really, really low wages. And those are the people that would probably volunteer for you instead of working for you because they want the flexibility of, okay, I don't feel like doing it. Guess what? I'm not going to be there this week. But once they're an employee, there's that requirement that they got to be there unless you're giving them really good vacation time, and most low wage positions don't give really good vacation time.
So we cover the hiring details. We covered initiating the advertising plan. Where does that stuff get posted?
Yeah, that's part of the I as well, because we could have, I like to say hiring is a lot like marketing in general. You could have the best marketing message out there, but if you don't put it in the right place for people to see it, no one's going to buy the product. So you have to make sure you post the job where your idea candidate is going to see it. We always, for all the positions we do and for everything, when we're coaching our clients, we say post on Indeed and post on LinkedIn because they have free options and they tend to be good platforms. They have a lot of people on there. Both platforms will try to get you to pay for your posting and suggest, oh, you'll get this many candidates if you post, put some dollars behind it. Don't put dollars behind it at first, because most candidates look from newest, it sort, so the newest is on top. And so if your job posting is just posted, you're going to be on top anyway. So I always say wait to put any dollars behind it. And a lot of times you'll get good candidates without having to put a lot of money behind it or any money on those platforms. Outside of those platforms, it really is going to make a difference on what you're hiring for. And being a nonprofit, there are a lot of nonprofit specific job boards out there. So you can post on them where you know you're getting in front of candidates that are looking for nonprofit opportunities, which, you know, we've mentioned pay a few times. Typically, if you took the same position and put it in a for-profit company, the nonprofit position is going to pay less. So sometimes that is the place to go to post a job because you know those are people that are specifically looking to work in nonprofits. They understand what it's like to work for a nonprofit, and then it's not always as lucrative as working for a for-profit company. Outside of that, it's really finding, are there specific niche job boards where it would be good? There's a lot of, instead of just general nonprofit job boards, there's a lot of nonprofit specific niche industry job boards. So for example, we've recently helped a lot of people in the legal aid area. So there's job boards out there specifically for legal aid companies and organizations to post there. So figure out, where are your people looking for it? What job board is attracting your idea candidate, and post it there? There are a lot of job boards out there that are expensive to post on. So we always go for the philosophy is try the free and cheap first, and then invest more money into some of the more expensive ones if you need to. But there's job boards out there that want you to pay like $700 upfront to post a job. And we don't think those ones are worth it because you don't really know if you're going to get a candidate you want to hire from there.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, Indeed and LinkedIn, those are the ones I've heard. I wanted to hear from the expert if that was the ones you recommend. So that's good. Posting free, no money upfront, better option to see what you get. I like that. So what's the R in hire?
Yeah, so the R is reviewing the candidates. So you posted your job, you're starting to get candidates in. Now you need to narrow them down to the person you want to hire. So this is a process that involves reviewing the resumes because you don't have a whole lot of time, which is why you're hiring for your organization. So you don't want to waste time interviewing a lot of people that shouldn't be interviewed, but you also don't want to accidentally weed out candidates that should be interviewed, but for whatever reason, you're looking at their resume and saying no. So we like to train on this very specific process to teach you exactly what it is that you should be looking for on a resume. So you can quickly, in a minute or less per resume, decide, should this person get an interview or should they not get an interview? And we're not trying to read between the lines and create their life story of what they might have meant by this. We look for very specific things, depending on what the job is, depending on those hiring details that we created, to say, here are three things that we should be able to identify on the idea candidate's resume. Does a candidate have these three things? Okay, they go in the yes pile. They don't have those three things, they go into the no pile. So that way, you're very, very specific on what you're looking for and not trying to figure things out by reading between the lines. I always like giving this example. I was working with a client once and she wanted me to kind of be that gut check of which candidates she was bringing in to interview. And I think she had like five candidates in her yes pile, four were good. And the fifth one, I was like, this person does not belong here. But I was like, okay, we're here. Like, I'm teaching her how to review these resumes. So I asked her, I was like, why is this person in the yes pile? And she thought about it and she goes, oh gosh, I don't know. And I was like, okay, well, what are our must-have criteria? What are we looking for? Okay, A, B, and C. Which one of these does this person have? And she's like, none. I'm like, so why did you put him in the yes pile? And her response was, after looking at it for a few more times to figure out what was going on here, her response was, because the resume was pretty. And that's like, it's always one of those things that's like, because the resume was pretty. And people hear that and they're like, I would never do that. But people do it all the time. People say yes to candidates for reasons that if you ask them why, they're not able to articulate. And they say no to candidates that really deserve an interview because they look at that and judge them on something that really doesn't matter for their ability to do the job. So that's why, like, we really like to follow this process of look for these things and only really look at these things to decide who should move on and who shouldn't. And then once you decide which candidates you are interviewing, we always say do at least two interviews. Not, you don't have to interview everybody twice because you can weed people out after the first interview, but you should always have two interview rounds where you ask very specific questions that tie back to those hiring details. So you're looking for someone who has this skill set. Let's make sure we ask a question that uncovers whether they have that skill set. You're looking for this in their background. Okay, are we actually asking about that? Do we know that about a candidate by the time we're done with those interviews? So every question should produce information of value to help you determine if someone is the right person for you to hire or not.
Ooh, I like that. I just saw a little interview with Elon Musk and one of those little, you know, scrolling through social media, it's a little video that pops up. And he's like, what's the best question that you ask? And he's like, I always ask, what's the hardest problem they've ever solved? And anyone that's not BSing you will have layer after layer of all the things that they've done to solve this problem. And someone that's just kind of making something up, they can only go like one-ish layers deep before they run out of material to explain, talking about the hardest problem they've ever solved.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's one of those things where, you know, what we ask obviously depends on what we're trying to uncover. And every position that we help hire for, we have a completely different set of questions. But a lot of times we have follow-up questions for our questions prepared. Because one of the things I always say is don't lead the witness. So don't necessarily tell them what you're trying to uncover with the first question. And you ask the question and then you zip your lips and wait for them to respond. Because I know I was guilty of this when I first started interviewing people. It's like, I ask the question and then I might rephrase it, or I might give them a little bit more information because I'm trying to make them feel comfortable. And then I realized, well, there's a lot of times I told them exactly what I wanted to learn. So they're going to go right there. Where we ask a question, we stop. And then depending on where they naturally take it, they might cover everything in our follow-up questions that we had, or they might not. And we then have the ability to say, okay, well, now tell me about this, or, you know, digging farther into it to get that information. Because like you said, there's some people out there prepare for interviews. So sometimes they have examples and they're not really the best examples. Like once you dig farther into them, you really learn that, oh, well, maybe they were a part of that project, but their actual role with that project is nothing like you would want it to be, or nothing like it really was when they first started answering the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What are some really good interview questions?
Oh, goodness. Okay. So I always find like this is a really hard question to answer because, like I said, every one of the interview guides we create are different because we really focus on those hiring details.
I imagine there's ones that are based on character, regardless what the job description is.
Yeah. And a little bit, it all depends, like, once again, what we're trying to uncover. The ones that I really like are more of the behavioral interview questions where you're really looking for examples. So they can't necessarily BS you and go out and say, well, I studied, so I'm going to tell you this answer. It's like, okay, well, and sometimes we ask the questions of, I'm trying to remember one of it was recently. We asked a question that tested their knowledge of, do you actually know what we're talking about? Oh, okay. Now that you said that you do, you got to give us an example, and asking for like a really specific example, because people could go out and study all day long. It's asking those questions that really dig into, have they actually done it? And how did they work, you know, through the situation and stuff like that? When it comes to some of the more general questions, these are some of the questions that go on to every one of our interview guides, is starting off of, can you kick us off with taking a few minutes to walk me through your work history? I feel that this question is really important because, one, it's an icebreaker question for the candidate. They know their work history. They can have a copy of their resume right there in front of them. They should be able to answer it. Two, while you already have a copy of their resume, you'll learn things that weren't on the resume. You'll also start to find out what was important to the candidate in that role versus like what they put here. So you could start to really learn like who they are a little bit and what they focus on. Are they also a candidate that you have a 30-minute interview scheduled, they're going to take 20 minutes to walk you through their work history? Or are they going to be someone who can be concise and tell you like, here's a brief overview, knowing that you're going to ask questions throughout the interview that's going to allow them to share more about their experience. Once we ask that, the next question that we always ask is, unless they shared it, why are you looking for a new opportunity? And then that gives us the opportunity to figure out, why is their current position not right for them? Because they could seem like the best candidate ever, but if they're leaving a company for a reason, and that exact same thing is going to be going on in your company, okay, they're not going to stay around. Mm-hmm. So if they're leaving because, let's say, there was no opportunity or room for growth, so they want to go someplace where there's growth, and you know that you have a pretty flat organization, that it's going to be a long time until there's any possibility for upward movements, and what's going to make them stay with you? Especially if it's a lateral move from that company to your company, and they're not getting that kind of like a promotion type thing and raise in pay and everything to come work for you. The other question that we ask all the time in our first initial interview is, even though we post the salary on the job posting all the time, we always say, what are your salary requirements? So that way we can figure out, do they fall into the budget? Now, in many states, you cannot ask a candidate what they currently make or what they have made at any of their jobs before. So I always say, don't ask about their current pay, but you're asking about what are their salary requirements to figure out if they say that they need $75,000 and you're looking to pay 50, okay, that's a problem. So why get all the way to the end and go make a job offer to find out that you can't afford a team member when you could have got to that upfront and said, okay, our budget is actually this. Would that meet your needs? And if it doesn't, say, okay, we're just going to stop the conversation here.
Yeah, I'm looking for $300,000 a month, a company car, a company plane, 3-month-long vacations every year, and I need my own colony on Mars. Like, can we make that happen?
Yep, no.
No,
but this is what we can offer. Would that meet your needs? And some candidates don't want to talk pay that much up front. And my suggestion for that is allow the candidate not to talk about pay, but you need to then make very clear of, this is our budget for the position. Would that match your needs? We can talk about specifics later. Because once again, you don't want to get so far in the process and then find out that you can't even come close to affording that team member. Because not only does it waste your time, it wastes their time as well.
Yeah, and it leaves it bad. Then you create someone that's going to go and badmouth your company all over town. Like, I can't believe I had to do this. And I got my third interview deep and we finally talked about money. And then we're nowhere close to anywhere meeting my needs and blah, 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 blah. Like, you can avoid that whole conversation by being upfront and posting some kind of range within the job posting.
Yep, exactly. And like I say, we always post it in the job posting. We still have people who don't look at it. So that's why I think it should always be a part of a conversation as well. Confirm that they know.
Absolutely. And so that's HIR.
That brings us to the E.
What's the
E? So the E is expectations for success. So once you pick your person, they're getting ready to start. As we talked about, training is an important part of the process. And it comes down to, you have to tell them what you expect of them out of this position. Because if you don't tell them your expectations, they're going to make them up. And chances are it's not going to match yours. So you need to be very clear on your expectations. And then you need to train them to get to where they need to be for that job. Even if they've done the exact same job in another organization, they've never done it for you. They don't know your work method. They don't know your processes. They don't know your systems. They don't know your clients yet. There's so much that they don't know that you have to teach them. Obviously, training someone who's done the position before, just in another organization, the training is going to look differently than if it's someone who has never done this and you're training them about job specifics as well of, here's how you do X, Y, Z. So the training is going to look different depending on if you are hiring an expert or hiring someone new, more entry level, but there's still so much you need to train on so this person can actually do the job the way you want it done.
Yeah, absolutely. We talked a little bit about leadership 101 when I was a guest on your show. Like, do they have the training? Do they have the capacity? That might be free time, headspace. It might be just those abilities. Not every job posting that you have is going to fit the person exactly. There might be duties that change hands just based on abilities. Have I given them the confidence they need to be successful? Have I set my expectations? I tell them, like, hey, I want you every day to be asking your manager about how to do A, B, and C. Or is it a wait and see kind of job? Is it, we're going to task you, and then when we task you, you run and do the stuff? And then have you given them the opportunity to actually do the job? Did you say, do this thing and then come back in 5 minutes? Like, is it done yet? Like, are you at that level of detail or control that you need to be all up in their business 3 seconds after you ask them to do the thing? Have you given them the ability, the time? Have you set your expectations? Are they trained? Are they capable? Do they have the capacity? If those are no or question marks, those have to be solved in order to give them the opportunity to even do the job.
Right. And I think the capacity and the ability are sometimes things for, it's very hard for people to grasp what that really means, because a lot of people think, well, I'm not going to train them. I'm just going to throw them onto assignments and they're going to do an amazing job. And then they're like, and then they're disappointed. And they're like, they don't have the ability to do it. They don't have the capacity to learn it. And I'm just like, did you even try to teach them? Like, it's not that they don't know how to do it. It's that they don't know how to do it the way you want it done yet. Or they're like, but I was working with someone once and they're like, it took them 3 hours to do this task that I could do in 45 minutes. And I'm like, yeah, but what they were doing, they had to navigate and find everything in the systems themselves, which they probably went to a lot of wrong places in order to find it because they're still learning how to navigate where you would be able to do two clicks, I'm there. Then they had, because this was a marketing thing, they then had to learn and figure out, okay, how do I learn your brand voice? You know your brand voice because you've been doing this. They don't know it yet. They're looking at examples. They're doing all this stuff. They're then trying to do, like, there's so much that they're learning as they're trying to do that first task that of course it's going to take them longer. Should it always take 3 hours? No. But those first few times, it's going to take them more time because they're still learning how to do it for you. And it's not second nature to them yet.
Oh, absolutely. There's some jobs that can be done and should be done from start to finish by one person. There's some jobs that should be done in segments and handing off to different people. I read an example of an organization that they had 10 people doing this job start to finish, and it took everyone different lengths of time to complete. They went down to break down each segment of the task. They found out that some people were really, really good and strong in the beginning section. Some were really strong in the middle section. And some guy, well, it turns out there's only really one guy really, really strong at the end. And they ended up sectioning out these tasks. And the people that really, really crushed the beginning, they did all of the 10 people's work for that beginning section. The ones that they handed it off to, there was two or three people that did the middle section. But there was only one guy that did the finishing stuff that was really clean, really efficient, and really loved doing that section. And when they went to that model, they found out they saved hours upon hours upon hours. The proficiency went up, the efficiency went up, and the amount of errors went down to functional zero because people were doing the right parts of the job. Just because someone has always done the whole job or the last guy did the entire job does not mean it's the right way to do it moving forward.
Yeah. And I think a great example for that in nonprofits is with development. Development and fundraising can mean so many different things. It could be events. It could be going out and getting the big asks. It could be grants. Like, there's so many different ways of, you know, bringing in the dollars to a nonprofit. And at the very beginning, you probably have one person doing all that, which also tends a lot of time to be the executive director, and eventually gets to a point where the executive director doesn't have the ability to do that because there's too much else on the plate. So they hire a single person in development. Well, as organizations continue to grow, often that one person can't be doing everything anymore. They can't be event planning and going out and getting these large asks and small asks and in-kind donations and writing grants and researching grants and overseeing the execution of grants. So you could hire another person in development and they just have the same title and they share the responsibilities, or you could start to hire someone that's a little bit more specialized. If your organization is big with grant funding, it probably needs to be a person who's specific with grants and the other person focuses on everything else. If you're an organization where you're doing a lot of events for fundraising, maybe having someone who does the event management is what you need, because that's one of your big funding sources and it needs to be a specialized person and take that off of someone else so they can focus on the other funding sources.
Absolutely. I always have the example of a guy that's a world-class fundraiser. He can go and he can talk to anybody. It brings him joy. It fills him up, gives him energy. And then he comes back to the office and you saddle him with another 6 hours of paperwork that he doesn't do very well or very efficiently. When he's out on the street talking to people, he's making buku dollars. He is bringing in truckloads. They're just backing into the nonprofit. They're unloading all this money on you, but you're going to stick him in the office doing paperwork and fine tuning these things because the other guy did it. Meanwhile, all the minutes that he spent doing the paperwork are completely draining him. It's taking longer than it should, and you're wearing down one of your best people that goes out and champions your nonprofit simply because you've decided that everyone needs to do all their own paperwork. That might not be true. And if you're going to lose him when he could be out on the street making buku dollars, and someone that loves just doing data entry and loves being behind the scenes could do the back end for that person, you're really losing out on a couple different fronts.
Yes, yes, exactly. Like, you know, I've seen it happen a lot. Like, when you try to have someone do every step of the process and it's not their wheelhouse, and people are like, but I can't hire this other person. I'm like, but what are you losing by not hiring this other person? You need to think about it that way. know, there should be a benefit because you hire this person, and what can happen. Now, at the same time, to pay someone, let's even say it's $50,000 and they're bringing in $10,000 and you're being like, yes, that's amazing. That's all you brought in all year. Oh, was that person really worth it? But if there's that positive ROI, that because you brought in this person, you're able to pay them X, and they're able to bring in a large amount of money to the organization over what they're being paid, then it's totally worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. If your $50,000 a year person brings you in $150,000, you might be happy. But if you're bringing a $120,000 person, they might bring you in $6 million. Mm-hmm. It's worth paying the extra money for the right person.
Yeah. So I'm on a board of a nonprofit around here. And that was like one of the conversations we've recently had. They're looking to bring in more people for their development team. And one of the things that they talked about was said, right now, we really can't afford the expert that we need. So what are our options? Do we bring someone in at a lower level and hope and pray that they do the right thing? And one of the things that they're talking about is starting with a consultant at first. So is really highly talented at what they need to do in that area. Help them get boots on the ground in this, because this will be a new area that they're looking at for funding sources. Get boots on the ground, help them figure out their systems and their processes and everything there. So then when that's developed, they'll be able to bring in that higher level team member because the systems and everything are created. They've already got traction there and everything.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So that's the hire process, hiring details, initiating the advertising plan, reviewing the candidates, setting expectations for success. I know that you mentioned in our pre-interview that better onboarding equals more longevity because you know what you're looking for. You make sure that they're a fit. You don't just interview them because they have a pretty resume. Although right. I have a very pretty resume. You should definitely interview me if I have a pretty resume.
I don't even think I have a resume.
Get a media kit that's like...
Right. I got a one sheet. You know, I got that.
Yeah. So what is your vision for growing your team?
Yeah, so our vision for growing your team is really becoming a resource for small businesses that need hiring help. And with small businesses, we include small nonprofits in there because even though it's a different tax, you know, thing, there's a lot of functionality that's the same. But to really be a resource for it, you know, I started this because when people were asking for the help, I couldn't find anybody who was speaking to small businesses specifically with hiring. And it was all like, yeah, we help small businesses, but their definition of a small business was companies over 50 employees. Well, you can't get to 50 employees if you screw up on your hiring really early on. Like, let's face it, there was a huge gap. And I want people to know that resources are out there, that they exist, that when you are going to hire your first team member or your 10th team member, that you don't have to do it alone, that yes, we all go to our peer network to say, how would you do this? But know that there are resources out there to help. So that's our thing, is helping growing your team become really known. So people know that there's support out there when they need it, when they want it, whether it is just listening to the podcast and hearing things that can help them along their journey, or becoming a client of ours and letting us help them in one of the ways that we serve our clients to really help them along their hiring journey.
Oh, and absolutely. If you love this conversation, you want to hear more great conversations like this, specifically with employees, check out the interview I did with Craig Handley. He's the author of Hired and Quit, Inspired to Stay. And the way that he handles employees that he has by helping them achieve their dreams is just absolutely phenomenal. Jamie, I wanted to thank you for being my guest today. Where can people find you?
Yeah, so you can go over to growingyourteam.com, and there you'll be able to learn more about who we are and what we do. And then we are on LinkedIn, Instagram, and Facebook, all under Growing Your Team. And then my podcast, which we have Travis's episode coming up soon, coming out, is the Growing Your Team podcast with Jamie Van Kuyk. And it should be available on all major podcasting platforms.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being my guest today. If you love this conversation and you're like, Travis, how do I get into podcasting? You can go to nonprofitarchitect.org/resources. Check out our free guide that we have. We have the Ultimate and Complete Podcast Guide. And we are no kidding. We have our course available for college credit at Forbes School of Business Technology and Belhaven University. You can take the same course online through that link, nonprofitarchitect.org/resources. Jamie, thanks again.
Yes, thank you for having me, Travis.
You've been listening to The Nonprofit Architect. To listen to all our past shows, visit http://nonprofitarchitect.org. And be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. Thank you.